This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. We are about to launch a new Renegade University website. If you want to participate in our 2.0 beta launch, join the Unregistered Underground, the supporting listeners network for the Unregistered Podcast. You can also get benefits such as access to the Unregistered Underground private Facebook group, where we have very interesting and lively discussions about all sorts of topics, and many former guests of the show are on that group. You can also get discounts on Renegade University and Unregistered Podcast merchandise. You can get exclusive access to Ask Me Anything live sessions and free Renegade University courses, including my What is Postmodernism course, my Renegade History of the United States video course, and my courses on World War II and the history of American foreign policy, Dangerous Nation. Go to unregisteredlisteners.com to support the show, to become a member of the Unregistered community, and get those benefits. Again, go to unregisteredlisteners.com to become a member. Recently in Brooklyn, we had the first Unregistered live show with Dave Smith and Nick Gillespie. It was raucous, sometimes contentious, but an absolute blast. Here is my interview with Dave Smith and Nick Gillespie live in Brooklyn. Welcome to the very first Unregistered live show. Thank you so much for coming out. This is a historic speakeasy, former speakeasy. I thought it was fairly appropriate for those of you who know my work. And I am so excited to have two of the greatest guests I could have in New York City, the great Nick Gillespie.
Thank you.
And the awesome Dave Smith. They told me before that they're all talked out. They don't have much to say. So it's basically just going to be me talking to you guys because these are not, they're sort of shy. They don't tend to talk much in public and they're nervous. So I wanted to go easy on them. So no questions for them. I'm just going to, you know, wait for them to contribute. But I wanted to start by talking about something that is something that Dave doesn't like to talk about, which is a non-political thing. He's a very political animal, you know, but he's been talking a lot about his change of mind lately about certain things. And nice Jewish boy from Brooklyn, raised in a liberal family in, what was it, near Park Slope, in Park Slope, right?
Park Slope, yeah.
Park Slope, yeah.
All right, Park Slope in the house.
Yeah.
Watch your fucking wallets. Park Slope.
I'm a former sloper here. I know all about it. So Dave, you've gone through some changes, apparently. You've had a child recently.
I have indeed.
This is a non-political topic, although maybe it is political. You're going to make it political in a second, aren't you? Now, you, because of this child thing...
I feel like you're about to talk show host me and go, and she's here! Yeah. And you're like, whoa, what? It's past your bedtime.
So you have a daughter.
I do.
How old is she?
She is 7 months and 1 week.
7 months and 1 week. Now, I've heard this has had quite an effect on you and the way you've been thinking about things, including about politics. You want to talk about that for a second?
Sure. Well, that's a broad...
are you talking about Jeffrey Epstein, then?
It's made me understand where he's coming from.
Yeah.
They're just... Everyone's into their own thing.
As long as nobody's being harmed.
Yeah. Right? Well, that's right. Yeah. No, everyone's voluntary. No, Jesus Christ. I'm going to say, these drinks have gone to my head. I'm going to say something wrong. No, but it has. I mean, I don't know. Doesn't having a kid, everyone who has a kid would say it changes your mindset on everything. Mm-hmm. And it, I'd say the main thing it made me realize was that there's something about the way we live today. Like in 2019 America, where I think that historically, usually there were like forces that we don't really deal with today, like chivalry, religion, loyalty, these expectations of like these kind of bigger things that you're supposed to live for. And someone like me, who's a 90s kid who grew up in Park Slope, who it was all kind of like about yourself. And your big thing was like, I don't know, let me finish my homework so I can play video games. I want to have fun. That's kind of the stuff we grow up with. Like, what's really important is that you're happy. And there's never like this central purpose. I didn't grow up with like God, country, religion, you know, any of this stuff. But once you have a kid, your life gets a little bit more centered, where you're like, well, I actually
do have
a purpose.
You got to figure out ways not to come home.
That's
like,
right.
How do I stay out of the house
I have
longer?
To avoid yeah. rocking a baby every
single night.
So wait.
But what, so how did this change your life then? I mean, be specific, because right now you're just kind of...
Who's the host here?
Yeah. What are you?
Sorry. Yeah.
It's fine. So no,
who's the
child? It's a free for all. It's okay. It's fine.
Yeah. I wasn't prepared to get grilled by Reason Magazine tonight. I'm ranting with Thaddeus
Russell. You should be outsourcing that parenting, you know, to somebody who's competent.
Listen, I have hired the best Chinese babysitter that
you don't even
Chinese
know if he's the
cents
same
a month.
Person.
That's so racist.
Yeah.
Is she supposed to be West Indian? What are you doing with a Chinese babysitter when there's West Indians all over the place who are willing to take that job?
They come cheaper.
Ah,
I'm a pure capitalist.
Well done.
But it does. It changes your mentality about everything. It's not. I always looked at it kind of like, oh, I want to have this career because that's what I want to do with my life, and I want to. You know, everything now is like, well, I need to do this so that she's okay. Like, that's my whole purpose, is just that she's taken care of. And then whatever. After that, if I make you assholes laugh, who really cares? You know, like, that's...
Now, you've also made some waves, as I understand it, and have you changed your position on abortion? Is
yes.
this the thing? Okay. And is
oh,
this...
man, we're starting with this.
Now, I hope... I yes, really I hope, have. And I know the answer to this, but I hope you're going to tell people that now you're in favor of it.
He advocates
having a kid, yeah.
Mandated.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Okay. Good idea.
No, come on.
Well, we'd have fewer assholes.
Yeah, we'd also have fewer...
People.
Everything.
Yeah. Well, you like Chinese people, so I thought that's what you were following on. You know, the Chinese attitude toward childbirth is not yours. But anyway, so tell me, so when was this because of having a kid, and you changed your mind on abortion because of this?
Yeah, I think it happened over the course of my wife being pregnant and having the baby that I was leaning in the pro-life direction, and then I fell into it.
You were leaning.
Yes.
Is this because you hang out with these libertarians who are Catholics?
Yeah, that might be part of it.
The Ron Pauls, the Lou Rockwells, the Mises Caucus.
I don't really hang out with Ron Paul.
Yes, you
do. I'm not like getting hammered.
Yes, you do.
But Ron Paul is a Baptist, and if he's still practicing as a Baptist, he understands that the Catholic Church is the world's largest cult, and it's the whore of Revelation 17.
Ooh.
So, but
I think I read that in End the Fed.
They're anti-abortion. Yeah. That was in the Ron Paul survival report.
Ooh.
The Pope is the whore of Babylon.
Okay, so we've begun with abortion right away, and then like Ron Paul's racist past.
But why are you against abortion though? Are you saying that from the moment of conception or why did your personal experience of your wife having a baby change your mind on that?
Well, okay, so I would say that and by the way, Nick, thanks for having me on your podcast.
Yeah.
That's why Nick's here, because I get tired.
I would say that it was there's a couple elements, right? So number one, when your wife is pregnant, if anyone here has had a baby or had been married to someone who's had a baby, right? When your wife is pregnant, yeah, but Nick, you had a baby in like 1971. I'm talking about people
that was post-sonogram
technology. If you've had a...
Yeah.
look, when you go in for bi-monthly sonograms, you learn a lot more about the development of a fetus. So there's that, which is just the scientific part of it, is that you learn
science.
How, well, you know, okay, science, that social,
you know what I feel about science, that, Dave. We covered this last night.
That's,
you know,
right.
Science is problematic, but keep,
so
keep going.
So there's that. I learned a lot more about the development of a fetus. There's also the emotional part of it, I'm sure, which is that, you know, you get very connected to this baby. And what I realized was, as I went through the process, look, there's really no abortion. The difficulty in abortion becomes like, when do you think, to me, it goes, when do you think it's an act of aggression to kill a fetus? When does a fetus become a baby? And the more I went through the process, it's like, well, okay, the idea, my body, my choice, and all that stuff, kind of, you realize how weak that is. I mean, really, my wife was, she was a week over her due date, so they induced her, because that's what they do now. They induce you. They don't let you go more than a week over because they think that's healthier. Then now, if it was 20 years ago, they would have let her go over. Maybe it would have been 2 weeks, 3 weeks over. Who knows? But they decided this is the day. So did they decide that that's the day? Now, I know you pushed me toward the other difficult end, which is, when does conception start? But I'm asking you, when is it a baby? You know, like, that's, yeah. And passing through the birth canal isn't some magical process. That was my baby one day earlier, just inside my wife. So would it be okay to kill the baby then? Is it okay to kill it the next day because it came out?
But that's not where the argument is. The argument is...
I don't know if you've been paying attention in Virginia. Yeah. That is exactly where the argument is.
The argument is... The argument in Virginia is, do you have to perform in blackface in order to be a man? Or if you are an African American, can you be a rapist? Is that a job requirement?
All right, Nick, that's very offensive. There's a 50-50 chance he was the Klansman in that picture. So,
but the real argument about abortion in America has to do with the first 3 months. Because like 90% plus of abortions are done before 8 or 9 weeks. So we're talking about is a much more less developed fetus.
Okay,
and
but
so the question is, like, you're making an argument then, because you don't know when it's a child. You say it's a child from the moment of conception.
Hold on. So you started by saying the first day, then I went to the last day. Right. We're both using extremes to paint a picture.
No, but I'm not.
The majority of abortions are.
Can you guys
the first
both
day.
Shut the fuck up for a second? So I have a question.
That's fair enough.
I have a question. No, I have a statement. I am sympathetic to Dave's argument, and I am sympathetic, I'm not on the side of the pro-life, so-called pro-life
Thaddeus
argument.
Russell, Christian conservative, everybody. I've converted one more. Where's the holy water?
Yeah. Did I do that right? I don't know. We can't prove or disprove that it's murder, can we? It's just not something that you can prove.
Well, could you prove or anything's disprove. A murder?
Well, so...
Well, some when it, people actually say...
Because babies don't talk. I mean, sorry, fetuses don't talk, right? We can't ever know what they experience.
That was going to be the next Look Who's Talking, or Boss Babe. It was going to be a fetus talking. But
thankfully, oh, yeah?
That never... one never... They couldn't get the script to work right.
But. Yeah. So, you know, what's the evidence that it's murder? But then again, what's the evidence that it's not murder?
So then you would tip to the side of saying, well, if it might be murder, the prudent thing is to just ban it, right?
Well, no. I just want to live in a state that, you know, allows it.
Yeah.
And so, but the good people of Mississippi have decided that it's murder. And I respect that. I just don't want to live there. I also think they're going to lose a lot of their female population because of it.
Now, is that Mississippi, or am I confusing it with Alabama? Is it the 8-week
Yeah, it's
rule?
Also Ohio.
Because that's not actually
Ohio
saying it's murder.
And Georgia.
And Texas, right?
Texas, I think, might have tried, and Virginia tried, but I don't think they ended up.
So the word murder is in some legislature there? Some legislation?
Let me just say, it's not a heart yet, because these are fetal heartbeat laws.
Mm-hmm, right.
And the organ is not fully formed then. So that, I mean, part of the problem here is
you can hear the heartbeat.
No, but it's not a heart. It's a pulse You know, it's an organelle. It's not an organ. And this is where the confusion, because we're talking about fetuses or unborn children, et cetera. Like, we're already in a slippery postmodern maze of language where the language kind of creates the outcome that you seek.
Oh, okay. When you say that there's, you're talking about the first day after conception, and that's not using an extreme to paint a point the way I was with the last day. No. The controversial bill that we're all talking about is 2 months. It's not the first day. No. Nobody's even arguing. Even these extreme right-wingers who everyone's like, oh, my God, there's a war on women's rights. By the way, the only individual right that the left seems to care about is to kill your baby. A little bit weird.
I'm going to have to just raise my hand from now on. So for the ignoramuses who don't read the news like me, can you please explain what this bill is?
Well, I know the one. I believe it's in Alabama where it's an 8-week ban. After 8 weeks, you can't have an abortion. And I think they called it the heartbeat.
Or something called like that. Fetal heartbeat laws.
So
once a fetal heartbeat is detected, then you can no longer legally.
So I mean, I don't know. That to me seems pretty arbitrary. I actually think that any point other than conception is a completely arbitrary time to say this is now a unique human being that has some degree of rights. I mean, the right to not be murdered. And by the way, this is all I'd say, right? Because we're not going to solve this. I'm not going to convince these two postmodernists.
Oh, yes, we are.
Agree with my moral belief. But I will say this: how about go look into YouTube, Google the actual process that is abortion. Because nobody ever, all of the pro-choice people I've talked to, very few of them ever seem to have any knowledge of what the actual process of abortion is. Go look into it. It is way more horrifying than you would think it is.
Fair enough.
And so I would just say that.
That's true of any medical procedure, unless you're a serial killer. Of course, it's disturbing. That's a terrible way to say I have a feeling of disgust or revulsion at some kind of physical process, so it should be banned.
No, I'm making Mathaddeus Russell
the antithesis of a libertarian rationality. Whoa. That's positive.
No, the libertarian rationality is really the non-aggression principle. And I'm asking you to think about whether this is an act of aggression or not. As Thaddeus made the argument last night, if you're going to debate the postmodernists, you should probably read the postmodernist literature. Not do what I do and just watch Jordan Peterson videos, right? So, which, as I said last night at the debate, I don't understand postmodernism at all, but my room is spotless. So I feel like I'm making progress. But I'm just saying, if you're going to debate the issue of abortion, you should know what the procedure looks like. That was all I was saying. I'm just saying.
Have you ever been involved in an abortion?
I am an abortion.
Have you seen? I have been.
What do you mean involved?
Have you ever been party to an abortion?
What do you mean party to?
Involved with a person who got pregnant.
Yes.
And you decided to.
Yes.
You know, terminate.
But I wasn't there for the procedure.
No. I'm not saying that. But
because for a second, it sounded like you were just hanging out while people were doing abortions.
Yeah, we just both admitted something really personal and private. That's pretty good. Well, and unregistered. That's in 16 minutes. We did that. That's good.
But I think it's important. And this was one of the, also putting this in a historical context. When abortions were outlawed, there's regardless of the morality of something, the policy did not work well to protect women. Or babies, because people just got illegal abortions that were much less safe, et cetera. I was just gonna say that a big part of that movement was women coming forward to say, look, I have had an abortion and I'm not a monster or anything like that. And I think men should be willing to also cop to the fact that, I've participated in this somehow.
Right.
I'm like not a Republican congressman, and yet I'm willing to admit this.
My mother went to Mexico to get an abortion in the 1960s.
Yeah. But he survived, everybody.
Exactly. I knew that was coming.
So here you go.
I just set him up. Here's the stand-up comic. I'll be your straight man. It's fine. Dave, your argument reminds me of what vegetarians say about meat. Well, go to the killing floors, in the cattle fields, right, and then see what happens in the slaughterhouses.
I don't think that's a terrible argument.
I don't either.
For a vegetarian? I don't know.
Data, but it's not,
it's not a terrible argument.
I wasn't saying this is a proof of my argument. Mm-hmm. I'm saying maybe you should know what you're talking about and know. So I don't think that's a terrible argument for a fucking vegetarian to make. But I'm just making the point that, look, if you're going to say when abortion was illegal, it didn't do anything to protect women or babies, well, I mean, how many abortions a year were there before Roe v. Wade compared to how many there are after? So if you look at abortion as killing a baby.
Do you want to know? Because depending on the estimates, it's everything from in the first couple of years after Roe versus Wade, or after abortion was legalized, there were about 1 million abortions a year. Some of the estimates before that was close to that number. So there were a lot, there were almost the same number of abortions. There were certainly, almost certainly more illegal abortions in the late 60s than there are legal abortions now because of better birth control and all sorts of other things. The actual number and incidence of unwanted pregnancies have been declining. So in a way, this issue is kind of being solved by technology and social changes. Which is good. And well, I think everybody wins in that sense. But when you say solved
by technology and social changes,
you're talking about abortion anymore.
Okay, so first off, I the numbers that I've looked at are nothing like that. Okay. That there was 1 million a year abortions before Roe v. Wade.
Please look it up.
I mean, I've never seen even estimates that come close to that.
Marvin Olasky's social, who is a conservative Christian writer, a journalism professor at UT Austin, and he wrote a book, A Cultural History of Abortion in America.
So maybe I'm wrong about that.
I know about one. Okay.
The one that didn't take. But there's one. But I'm just saying, okay, fine. But if you're saying there's something interesting, that there's an admission in there to saying that technology will solve this issue, and by solve it you mean there'll be less abortions.
Well, if there's nothing wrong with abortion, there will be no need for abortion.
Right. So there'll be less of them. So I'm just saying, why is it even solving something? If there's no moral issue, do you think that there's no issue with it, then why solve it?
We won't be talking about it. And also, by the way, are you going to then ban, because if you become anti-abortion, then you're also signing on to saying, okay, well, we're going to get rid of certain types of birth control, certain types of contraceptives, abortion pills. The genie is out of the bottle in terms of individuals have more control over what they're doing in their lives. It's harder and harder for the police to show up and say, don't do this, don't do that. So if you are signing on to a strict anti-abortion program, you are signing on to building up the state and giving the state the right in the name of protecting unborn children or nearly born children to come in and kick doors down and put people in cages and all of the raps that you want to do about stuff.
Okay, so you're right.
So it's obviously, I'm just saying it gets complicated.
Well, if we're talking about the political issue of building up the state, we all know the people who preach for abortion rights are always real small government libertarians, right? They're the least status amongst us, right? It's always the good AOCs of the world who are for some reason, think about that. By the way, isn't it strange that the biggest status amongst us, the only time they will use libertarian rhetoric is when they're talking about a woman killing the baby inside of her. You'll actually hear a Democrat say the government should get out of healthcare decisions. Is that not an amazing moment in time?
It's good, and we can work with this. We can work with this. And by the way, abortion did not become a Democratic issue until years after Roe versus Wade, partly because abortion, the people who are anti-abortion, it's a religious argument fundamentally. It's a theological argument that they're making. It's not a medical one, and it's not a legal one, because the concept of personhood, there's the biological...
So then is being anti-murder a religious argument?
No. What I'm saying is that there is a biological development of the fetus from, an ovum, a fertilized egg into potentially a human being, right? There's a biological development. The thing that governs this is personhood. And at what point does the fetus gain the rights, all or some of the rights of a fetus, of a person? And that's the argument that we're going to have. The arguments against abortion, I'll get to that in a second, but the arguments against abortion always come ultimately from a theological point of view. And that's why they talk about the moment of conception, because they believe in souls and things like that, which I don't believe in. I think, and this is something I'm curious what people here think, there is not a clear moral distinction to say, okay, yes, never have abortions, or yes, always have abortions. We have kind of hashed out a social convention where we say, through the first 3 months of pregnancy, the woman has nearly total control over her body, and she can get rid of she can end a pregnancy, and that's it. And Americans are kind of good with that. It tracks with earlier kind of folk traditions about ensoulment or about the quickening of the fetus, a certain level of development. And what we have said is that everybody recognizes this has the potential to become a human being, but up to a certain point, and that line is going to change based on technology, on viability, all of this kind of stuff, we're going to draw that line, and it's going to be kind of shifting.
But I want you to answer Dave's question.
Okay.
Which was, when is it murder according to you?
Yeah, I think the point of viability, when the fetus or the child, because it stops being a fetus, I guess, in my formulation, and when it can exist outside of the mother. So when there's a level of viability. And that line will be walked back because it's already, you know, fetuses can survive outside the womb now, you know, much earlier than they could 20 or 30 or 40
years ago.
So
the law, which is the law of the land where we are sitting right now, which is that you can get an abortion for the first two trimesters, no questions asked for anything you want. Mm-hmm. Abortion is murder in your mind. Because you absolutely are viable, at least potentially
at
viable.
Not at the end of the first trimester.
In the second trimester. The law, but I'm saying the law of the land right now, so abortion is murder.
Excellent point, Dave.
So you're not that far off from me.
I mean, I agree. I don't think, but are you saying that there shouldn't be any abortion? I mean, are you saying it should be banned? It's one thing to say I'm against it or I wouldn't participate in it, but you're a statist.
Do you not think that murder should be banned?
Come on.
I'm really going to go out there on a limb and say, you know what? I am a libertarian, but I am against murder.
And
I
so,
think it is a crime.
Yeah, but that's right. So you're calling me a statist. I guarantee, Nick, and by the way, everyone knows, I love Nick Lespie. Yeah. I fucking love this guy, okay? But the idea that you're calling me a statist, you support more statism than I support. The one area I won't support
I
is murdering
now?
Babies. I mean, but come on, man. The one area that I'm saying the state should be involved with is don't murder a fucking baby. And I got Nick calling me a statist for that. I'm an anarcho-capitalist.
You're not a libertarian. You're an anarcho-capitalist.
That's the most libertarian position.
No, I think it's I think it's actually different than libertarianism.
Let's move on to something more fun.
Libertarianism.
We've gotten
more laughs out of an abortion conversation than most people could hope to get. I will say that.
Give it up.
Very rare.
Give it up.
You get an abortion debate with a few punchlines in the middle.
I think that libertarianism or libertarian view of government is simply, limited government, more limited government than we have now, but government is not allowed to do everything. It's not allowed to vote. You can't vote away your rights. But it's not anarchism. It's a really kind of white bread centrist position, which is that for the most part, the default setting should always be that people are free to make whatever choices they want in their lives, but there are moments where we need a political consensus. I don't have a problem with certain types of infrastructure, taxation. I don't think all taxation is theft, et cetera. I'm not an anarcho-capitalist. I'm only going to live to be 200 because of great innovations in technology and stuff like that. And given that, I don't have time to be like, oh, well, you know what I really want to do? It's like, we got to get these fucking sidewalks privatized, man. You know, like, I can't even go outside without having to be, you know, walking on the man's streets or something. Like, I want to get on with my life. I also don't want to have conversations about abortion anymore because it's kind of like, if you want an abortion, you can get one and it's safe and it's effective. And if you don't want to, and if you want to preach to people and say don't get abortions, you can do that, and you might change their minds.
I mean,
Thalidomide baby in the corner there clapping his flipper.
If you're saying you're
an anarcho-capitalist, that's all. It's different than being a libertarian. Is just a limited government, not a 19th century classical liberal.
So government should be limited to what?
It's an ongoing argument.
Right, and I'm saying they should be limited to nothing.
Yeah.
So I'm the most libertarian position you can have.
That's anarchism. It's not libertarianism because you don't believe in government.
I believe it exists.
Is it not the purest form of libertarianism, though?
It seems to be, but I think libertarianism exists in a kind of spectrum here. Mm-hmm. Anarchism is something different, and anarchism can be right wing or left wing. Mm-hmm. I don't understand left wing anarchism at all. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we want to get rid of the state
because
the state will do everything.
Right, because it's communism.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
But I do think that anarchism is, we'll be arm in arm in the barracks. decades, right up until we have to fight about abortion. but I think it's, I actually do think it's different. And I have to say, I've been a, you know, a professional libertarian for about 25 years, a little bit more. And libertarianism, you guys are like the Sith Lords of libertarianism.
Yeah.
You've infected libertarianism with anarchism.
And with logical consistency.
Being anarcho-capitalism. Nobody was talking about the non-aggression principle 25 years ago. It was not the default definition of libertarianism.
Oh, yeah?
Well, no, because...
Didn't know that.
Absolutely not.
Because I'm new to this weird shit.
Yeah.
Well, your definition of libertarianism that you just gave, it's like it begs the question, why? I mean, you're like, okay, well, I think the state should be limited to this. I don't really want to spend my time fighting about this. Yeah. Maybe they could do this, but politics should
I'm
why?
Not a foundationalist.
Why do you believe that?
I'm not a foundationalist. I don't really, like, first principles are interesting to talk about and things like that, but it is, I have a sensibility that I should be free, that you should be free, that all of us should be free, and that this evening should have been free, but Thad insisted on charging a substantial amount of money without even a buffet. I mean, we were at a debate last night these guys performed in different ways, and $10, $12, $24 get you a buffet as well as a debate.
There were probably leftovers.
But they weren't beyond all of that, no, I mean, this is, I think... The role, the size, scope, and spending of government is something that we'll always be talking about, because the minute you know, I don't believe in pure anarchism, and I don't feel a need to create a foundational system on that. I know what I believe, and I'm comfortable with that, and I think I can show pragmatically it's good, and that morally, it, in general, it's better to give people more choice rather than less choice, and everything kind of proceeds from that. But it's not an absolutist argument.
But why are you not an anarchist? I don't get it. What's holding you back there?
It's the logical conclusion. It doesn't interest me. It's a boring, sterile debate, because in the end, and it's like, and that's why the government shouldn't do anything. And it's like, okay, and now what are we going to do for our lifetimes? Because the government is going to be here, the state is going to be here, and what I would rather do is move in the direction of more freedom and figure out how to do that.
Yeah, but
and to your point, Thad and I talked for a reason.
Have I made points tonight? I don't remember, but go ahead.
Yeah. No, but you know, your renegades, right?
The people,
you know, the heroes, your spirit animal.
Sure.
You know, I think in a lot of ways it's a waste of time to be like, okay, I'm going to create this perfect system and then try to enforce it, as opposed to let's just start living our lives. And we ignore laws that we don't like, and we support laws that we do, and we try to change laws that we don't like.
But because I'm about to support you. But shouldn't anarchism be the guiding standard or the guiding principle of libertarianism? Isn't it sort of what you should move toward at all times? Because it is the logical conclusion of your politics.
I think smaller government. Yeah, kind of, but not always.
Unless you actually are a semi-statist. You're a minarchist, it sounds like.
But are you committed
to that in principle? In other words, do you think that government should control certain portions of the economy?
I don't think they should, but I accept that they are going to.
Oh.
And then we move in that direction.
Then what's the difference between us?
Yeah.
Because I'm
This is already, I find this a very tedious conversation.
Then we can go back to abortion if you want.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't know if anyone knows this, but I hesitate to even say this publicly, but on policy questions, public policy questions, I'm with Dave. Like, I'm with Ron Paul. Like, my... But hold on.
So you, like Ron Paul, every year he was in Congress, introduced like a sanctity of life argument.
Except
that would
for
ban
that.
All abortion. So that's
except
where
for
you
that.
Are.
That's the one difference we have. No, but I mean, my voting record, if I were ever a congressperson, which I won't be, but would look pretty much like Ron Paul's. Okay? Now then I add a bunch of other stuff, like which I introduced last night, talking about the postmodernism stuff. But I do think it's if you're going to take on libertarianism, you're always going to be haunted by the specter of the anarchists who are going to be telling you what you really should be, because that is,
to me, the logical conclusion
of libertarianism.
What should there be public schools? Should there be public schools?
No.
Okay. Hell no.
All right. Given that
public schools are the reason we're in the position we're in right now, by the way. This is the reason why we are where we are right now,
given that there are public schools. So like what you would do if you were a legislator or if you're an activist, you would just be like, I'm going to work for the banning of tax-funded schools, period. Or are you going to be like, you know what, a policy that actually has a chance of being enacted and working and is happening is something like charter schools or school vouchers or things that give people in any given situation more choices and more options and moves towards smaller government and more autonomy. That for me is like, in terms of, that's as much time as I want to spend devoted to politics and to policy. And I spent a lot of time talking about policy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think getting rid of capital controls. Like, I don't, you know, we don't need the government to print money or anything like that. But in the meantime, you know, before that happens or before Bitcoin and crypto really takes off, we can move towards a world where the government can't, a state can't say, you can't take your money out of this country. You can't use supplementary cash and currency and things like that. So it's like that's, I'm just pushing in those directions.
Let's talk about schools, okay? And let's talk about children who are living. Okay, so Dave has just begun parenthood. Nick and I, we haven't ended it, but we sort of are. Yeah. But the so Nick's youngest kid has just graduated, well, recently graduated from high school, as has mine. So we're kind of at the end of that period. So you're entering
intensive period. Yeah. Now we're in the we're going to go bail him out of jail phase.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, what do we have to say to Dave? What do you want to say to Dave about that experience? How did you feel? How do you feel about parenting? You told me last night or yesterday when we were hanging out that, you know, you have very mixed feelings about now being an empty nester.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, is just a kind of sociological fact of, you know, you're at the very beginning of this where it is, you're absolutely right that having a kid recenters your world and your world gets recentered on the kid. And then when they're out of the house, they don't need you as much, mm-hmm. and you have to get on with your life. So there's that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
There's a larger question if we're talking about education and whatnot. It's my two sons, one's 25 and one just turned 18. They went to a mediocre but well-rated public high school in a college town in Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
It was a terrible waste of time and money.
Mm-hmm.
You know, schools are minimum security prisons. They look exactly like minimum security prisons. There should be a million, given the amount of money, the billions of dollars that we spend on education, K through 12 and everything else, there should be a million different models of delivering education, including something like Renegade University, you know, drive-through, you know, everything. There should be, you know, a education by drone delivery, for fuck's sake. So
this has come a long way from charter schools.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, trust me, but it's like, you know, what would be good and what I think is doable, what is achievable in the next year or the next 10 years is introducing more choice and more individualism and personalization of education.
But are you for the abolition of public schools, Nick Gillespie, yes or no?
Yeah, I would love to see a day when, you know, I would love to see a day when the Air Force has enough money to bomb all the schools having bank sales, right?
So you're a militarist anarchist.
Yeah. It's very confusing. It's my head is not a good place to live.
Okay. You're the Curtis LeMay of anarchism.
That's right.
Okay.
Of K through 12 education.
That's right. Yeah. So I, you know, my son just was released. I say he didn't graduate. He was released from his 13-year sentence. Dave, what are you going to do about schools? I mean, I know it's early to think about this, but you got to, right?
Well, what I know is that I will not be sending my daughter to one of those government prisons. I promise that. Over my dead fucking body, will I ever put her in one of those
prisons. Yes, my brother, but it ain't so easy, right?
Yeah,
because someone's got to have the time and the resources to teach the kids, unless you don't want to teach them.
Yeah. I mean, look.
Which is fine,
I get it. It's easy. Like, it's easy to say. And it's almost like if someone doesn't have a kid and they're like, well, I will raise my kid in X, Y, and Z way. And
they'll never have sugar. They'll never watch TV.
Sure.
All of this kind of stuff. One of the great, if you haven't had kids, one of the great joys of being a parent is like hanging out with people who are like, well, you know, my kid is never going to have Kool-Aid. My kid is never going to watch TV. My kid is never going to do this. And within that, I'm sure you had this experience, within a couple of months, you go back to that place and the people are like shoving sugary sweets in front of their kid who is like Alex in Clockwork Orange.
The best was
right in front of the TV.
We will get back to Dave in a second, but I will say that for me, I don't know if anybody knows about this, but Baby Einstein, this was heroin for babies, which, you know, was horrifying, and it turns out it actually retarded their development in some way. But I didn't care.
Parents, right?
But hell yeah, man! I put my son right in front of that shit all morning long, so I had those precious 3 hours, and he was just like slack jawed looking at the thing for 3 hours.
Loop of classical music and like really expensive toys.
Yes,
kind of
total scam. Yeah. But it just completely drugged them, and I was able to, you know, watch porn then. So anyway, so.
So I get it.
So back to you, Dave. So, you know, New York City, it's going to be tough, isn't it? You know, you're busy. Your wife's probably busy. You know, you got lots of things going on. You can't even get groceries without going through some hassle here. You can't
you
do
got all the side
buying
bitches.
Diapers is a pain in the ass.
No, got
the
Jeff side Bezos bitches, figured yeah. this out.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Right. Everything's delivered by drone right now. You got the drone delivery. So, no, but how are you going to, what are you thinking? Again, you got several years to figure this out, but what are you thinking? How are you going to do this? Are you going to homeschool?
Private or home?
Now that you're a Christian, that's what you should do, right?
Yeah. One of the two.
Really?
Okay. That's what I'm thinking right now, but I don't know. We got, you know, we got a few years to work it out, and I also have to sell my wife on my, you know, craziness, but she'll be
Are there political differences in the home?
No, my wife's not like very political, and she more or less agrees with me. Mm-hmm. But on the school whatever we end up doing on the school thing, I have to kind of sell her on. My wife, the most political thing I think that my wife, which by the way is good for me, because like if I was in a relationship with someone who was also super political, I'd probably just lose my mind.
Oh, yeah.
Like I need, she's like my escape from this.
Yeah,
you
don't
know,
don't
world.
Do that.
But she, her biggest political thing I think that she had before we met was that she just loathed modern feminism. Like she was just like they're out of their fucking mind, and like so that was like her big thing, and it kind of lined up, and then we just fell in love, and you know it's like she's not a super political person, but whatever I do schooling my daughter, you know, I'd have to, I don't even like that term schooling, it's like that's not educating, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say that. Can I just say one thing? I'll be very quick with this, just about what we said before, like the case versus whether you should sit here and say, hey, I support the abolition of public school, or I support like a charter school program, or you know, it's almost like saying I support the abolition of the income tax, or I support a reduction of 10%, and you know, what's more practical. This is, and by the way, this is from Gene Epstein, the host of the Soho Forum last night, and this is what he said, his case for radicalism, and I love this. And he goes, look, if you were sitting around in 1840 and you said in 25 years slavery is going to be abolished in the West, any reasonable, let's be practical person would have said, you're out of your fucking mind. Mm-hmm. Slavery's not going to be it's been this way forever. Mm-hmm. There's no chance. If you were sitting around in 1980 and you said in a little more than 10 years, the communism is going to fall, they'd be like, what are you talking about? Mm-hmm. There's no chance of this. Yet all of those things happened. Yep. So I'm just saying, I think there's a strong case for radicalism. We live in a whole new era. If you're telling me education, now that I have in my pocket every piece of information that's ever been written through all of human history, and you think we can't get rid of these government buildings with these same old lame, fucking sad, childless, middle-aged women fucking droning on government propaganda to our kids? We can't get rid of them. Of course we can. And it's almost, and this is, I don't think history is predetermined. Like, we decide what it's going to be. So instead of saying, let's take this position, let's just go for what's right. Abolish government schools. Save the fucking world.
I think you just lost me another girlfriend. Because when I had Malice on, Michael Malice on, which for the first episode, yeah, of Unregistered, he called public teachers vermin. You may remember this. Okay.
Amen.
So, you know, like Dave, I tend to date and be with women who are really not political in the ways that I am, because it's hard to find women like that. And so they tend to be of the NPR Liberal Democratic Party variety, you know, so you kind of look for the most open-minded of those. But she has, and many of them have, lots of friends who are public school teachers. And she heard this episode and she said, well, first of all, you know, Malice was tough for her. But it was an insult to her and all of her friends and everything she stood for, and it was a real problem for me. So I, you know, now I'm worried that the new woman I'm dating, who also knows a lot of knows a lot of teachers, you've just ruined it for me. Thanks, man. Hanging out with libertarians is dangerous.
Yeah.
At least for your love life. So, but I agree with you entirely.
I feel about public school teachers the way Donald Trump feels about Mexicans. I'm sure some of them are good people, but they're not sending their best. You know what I mean? Like, they're rapists, they're criminals, and some, I'm sure, are good people.
I was just in Oakland. I was just in Oakland, and I guess the teachers just went on strike there, and so of course all these idiot liberals all over Oakland have all these signs saying, "We stand with the teachers of Oakland." And I actually got to the point where, and of course they have them in front of their houses, in front of their like signs to say, "Black Lives Matter, and everyone's welcome here." And that's, you know, the bravest thing possible to say in Berkeley, California, right? And by the way, are you going to allow refugees into your home? Is that what that means? But you know, I would see these signs that say, "We stand with teachers," and I actually got to the point where I would stand, and I was so infuriated. I was like standing in front of their house and say, "Did you like any of your teachers?" You know, I would confront you. "Did you name one of your teachers in all 13 years who you like? How many were there? Why do you stand with these assholes? They tortured me every fucking year, right?" It's like this cognitive dissonance among liberals. They ask a person who's a liberal, ask anybody, how many of your teachers, if they went to public schools, right? How many teachers did they actually like? Did they actually get educated by? And they'll say, "Oh, maybe one or two," which was like me. I said one. One out of 13 years of all those people. But yet again, when it comes to the teachers' unions and teachers generally, when they think in the abstract, because the left, of course, loves to think about people in the abstract, not actual human beings in front of them, right? They'll all say, "Oh my God, we've got to give them more funding and more help, and we've got to support them, and what heroes they are." No, teachers in public schools, right, guys, are not heroes. They were not my heroes. They were my enemies.
Can we extend this a little bit to get off of the libertarian hobby horse? The man who works for a libertarian publication says,
"I'd love to." Sports?
Isn't what do we want to do? No, isn't it true though that most teachers at private schools suck just as bad, and it's exactly the same model? It's exactly the same model.
This is what I hear, but I'm not rich enough to know.
I went to a parochial Catholic school. It cost like a couple hundred dollars a year. I went to a high school that I paid for. The teachers there were not good. I tried to get my parents to allow me to go to the public school because the education was better there. What I'm saying is, we should also be thinking broader than just in terms of very like state versus non-state actors. The models of education are oppressive, they're imperialistic, to use a term you like. They are the antithesis of actually allowing people to develop and grow and to flourish and to cultivate their individuality.
So I completely agree with the second part of that, but not so much with the first part. So I do agree that the whole model needs to be
blown up.
We need to completely rethink this. I mean, the idea, if you just think about the concept of how much technology has evolved, and yet the idea of school, this Prussian model of school, that we still go, you sit, the precursors to the Nazis, these are who came up with the whole concept of school, right?
Correct.
I mean, like that's some real, that, like, this is about indoctrinating children. And the idea of, like, sit in a row of desks and memorize and regurgitate, like, when did we decide this is how our children should be brought into the world? If you look at, like, little kids, like 3-4-year-olds, they have this intense instinct for two things. Number one, they want to know. That's the old joke, like kids, they go, why? Like they keep asking you why, because they want to know. And the other thing they really want is to participate in the adult world. Like you have to pretend they participate.
This is going to end with you saying you want to bring back child labor, right?
Well, I mean, you know, maybe. I don't know if there should be laws.
Anything that's peaceful.
We have child labor right now, but it's just for the state in these public schools. I'm just saying, you know these kids, 3-year-olds, you go like, they'll literally want to stir something while their mom's baking or their dad's baking. And then at the end, when you have the brownies, they're like, "We made brownies and I helped." Like, they love that. They want to know stuff. They want to help.
Why are you spending so much time with other people's kids? And you're like, you're out on a weeknight you're leaving your own kid. You know, what are they up to?
My nephew. What are you assuming is going on here? But I'm just saying, and then you take that creative energy and you stick it in this memorize, regurgitate, it's horrible. It's evil. Like, I don't know what else to say about it. But that being said, as someone who went to public school and private school, there's a reason why these parents are paying so much money to get their kids in private school.
It's a class thing.
It's better. All schools actually learn something. And I thought the private school I went to sucked balls, but the public school I went to was downright criminal. Like, I, as a libertarian, I go, some of these people should have been arrested for what they were doing. I mean, I'm talking about physical abuse, threats of physical abuse daily. Now, maybe there was one teacher who was good in that whole building, but there were straight up criminals.
I was thrown into a closet once by a substitute teacher. I was thrown through a door, and my sixth grade teacher at Columbus Middle School in Berkeley, California, Mr. Perrone, loved that guy. He used to pick us up by the seat of our pants and just carry us across the room and then drop us when we were out of order.
The fact of education and educational achievement is that it tracks very closely with parental achievement.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's like you guys can talk about all of this, but this is a place for a Marxist critique of it. And there's no question that public schools and private schools are set up in order to recapitulate or replicate the existing class and status order.
Yes.
And that is the reason why there is no fucking way. Like, I have my sister is a dean of students at Notre Dame. The kids going in there, they're not learning any more at Notre Dame than they are at Indiana University.
Right.
But they come in at a higher level of income, and they come out on somewhat on a higher level of income. But they're not learning anything more. This is selecting for peer effects and things like
that. Yeah, the poor get trapped in these public schools,
and
of course.
And that, by the way, is one of the reasons why I agree with, you know, if we can get rid of state-sponsored education, because I don't think the role of education should be the creation of good citizens, which is the Prussian model tied to a kind of industrial factory model.
Meaning good workers and good soldiers.
That's right, yeah.
Which was explicit, by the way, in this country. You said, you asked when it began. This was in the 1830s in America. Horace Mann, who actually founded my college, Antioch College in Ohio. He was explicit about it. We need workers in the factories that are beginning to develop here in the United States, and we need soldiers to fight in all the wars we're about to embark on as an imperialist country. It's explicitly. That's why schools are designed as assembly lines, with the bells and the moving of the children from spot to spot, doing one task after another.
One of the things that I think can be done and has been done, and this is where charter schools, you know, and it's not sexy. It's not as sexy as like Rock and Roll High School, where the Ramones blow up Vince Lombardi High at the end. But, you know, charter schools give poor people choices that they wouldn't have other, not in 5 years and not in 10 years, but like next in the fall. And that's good. So, and again, I'm not saying when it comes to politics, and I guess this goes back to the anarcho-capitalism versus libertarian thing, I'm just not a utopian. Like, I don't care enough about politics to be utopian. And all I want, I'm happy to spend a little bit of time thinking about it and trying to make marginal increases in autonomy and freedom and things like that. And then I want to spend most of my time reading and writing the stuff that I'm interested in and kind of living my life.
But anarcho-capitalism and the anarchism that I'm attracted to is not utopian. I mean, right? You don't hear.
I think it's the antithesis of utopia.
I never hear.
I think
but it is in that we want the absolute destruction of the state.
Yeah, but they don't. No. But ANCAP, sorry, but ANCAPs don't talk about utopia. Marxists talk about utopia. Socialists talk about utopia. But I've never heard an ANCAP describe the perfect society that's going to arrive once we, you know, eliminate the state. Right?
I think it's more utopian. It's much more utopian to think that we're going to have a state that will remain small than it is to think that we could abolish the state. I mean, look, what more proof do you need that a state, the United States of America, the country that we live in right now, was all founded by these guys who had really thought about the checks and balances and the power of the state?
Yeah,
these geniuses. We are sitting in the biggest state that has ever existed in the history
of humanity. Are you more free than your parents were? Not in terms of, like, is the state bigger in terms of the amount of
both
money?
Both are true. The state is bigger, and I am freer.
So that's all I'm saying. Like, I'm not gonna burn the last 120 years or whatever I have, or 140 years I have left, but trying to get down to zero there, because it's like I can be more free now, I'm not gonna be able to strangle the put the state in a bathtub and strangle it. Like a fetus.
Okay.
I guess. Like, if it's a kid,
sure. Well, there'd be no.
Even in the second trimester.
Okay. Well, look, I'm going to borrow a thought from the brilliant Scott Horton, who's one of my very good friends. He's been on the podcast before.
Yep.
And like what he said, look, if you're judging the Soviet Union, okay, you don't judge the Soviet Union like morally, or judge them as a society by how the wealthy, politically connected in the outskirts of Moscow lived. You judge them by the gulags. You judge them by the people in Afghanistan being carpet bombed. That's how you judge them. So if you're judging our state today, you don't judge it by the fact that I'm a little bit freer than my parents are.
No, but
you
judge them by the. No, well, let me just
finish.
Is. Hold
on. Let me just finish my thought. You judge them by the prison industrial complex. You judge them by the million dead in Iraq. You judge them by the genocide going on right now in Yemen. Okay, where there's babies starving to death because our state, this powerful state, has signed off on the Saudi war. Okay, which is really our war. So that is, yeah, I am a little bit freer than my mother was, okay. But my point about a state, my point is that the utopian model is that we could have a limited state that this power, this group that has a monopoly on aggression, a monopoly on the initiation of force, they'll be in charge of limiting their own power. And they will keep it limited.
So, Nick, what were you getting at with this? What was the question? You're saying there's more state, but Dave is freer. So, what are you getting at?
There is a paradox, and there's a limitation to libertarian thinking, I think, or narco-capitalist, which and you hear various people talk about this, that if the state grows, individual freedom or liberty shrinks. You know, it's a zero-sum game.
That's it. Okay.
I think that is fundamentally false. And here is one thing I'll say as a libertarian. One of the ways that we need to free our minds to really get to a space that would develop a world that's very different, if you spend all of your time muttering under your breath about the fucking state and this and that and this and that, you are wasting valuable energy that could go into the creation of an alternative world that you could be living in right now. That's all. And again, this is not really a win or lose kind of conversation or something like that. What I'm saying is we need to be thinking much more broadly about what does human freedom mean? And I actually, and this is where I think libertarians and anarchists are different. I do think that there are a lot of people who are going to come into the world for reasons that they are not responsible for, where they will have no chance at actually kind of fulfilling their promise or exercising their autonomy. And that is a place where collective action, and it's mostly going to be done through the state, it doesn't have to be, can help. And it can give people who have no means, who have no connections, who have no parents, a little bit, a step up so that maybe they can live a life that's closer to what they would have lived had they been born under better circumstances. Mm-hmm. That's all.
What do you think, Dave?
There's kind of a difference between freedom and liberty. So the reason why we have more freedom today is because of the market growing, because of technological advances. Yeah. I mean, that's where the freedom comes from. But the state growing bigger and bigger does come at the expense of liberty. So you might be in a situation where, look, I mean, you could argue that somebody who's sitting in a jail cell today in America has more... a higher standard of living than somebody
person in the Depression, right? Or
well,
something.
Well, yeah. Yes. I mean, maybe, but they have far less liberty. So the state comes at the expense of liberty, not necessarily freedom. And all of the advances that we've had have come from technological innovations.
Absolutely.
And those will be crushed if the state keeps growing bigger and bigger. Mm-hmm. So
no, but they aren't. They're not. The state keeps growing bigger and bigger, and technological innovation changes more and more stuff.
That seems like a fundamentally anti libertarian argument. You're saying
all I'm saying is like don't waste all of your time worrying about
but
the
that's
state.
What socialists in this fucking neighborhood tell me all the time, right?
They're obsessed with the state and growing the state. I mean,
I say what Dave's been saying, which is to them, to these communists when they're on my show and when I meet them on the streets when they're not yelling at me, that you know, they say, don't worry, Thad, you're very paranoid. Of course there's going to be freedom under, you know, a giant state apparatus. And in fact, the more the state is, the larger the state is, the more freedom there is. So you're sounding like a Marxist again.
You sounded like
a Marxist yesterday, by the way.
I'm worried
about you.
If past performance is any indication of future outcomes, I'll sound like a Marxist tomorrow.
Okay.
Because I'm not saying, I don't want the state to be larger. I want the state to be more limited.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
But, you know, it just fundamentally... I'm not interested in having a long, drawn-out conversation about how do you get to zero. My question is, how do you get closer to zero? How do you move in that direction? And then also recognizing that, you know what, like, you know, wonderful things happen all of the time because of free markets, because of innovations, because, and actually it's not even economics. Like I also think the libertarian movement and the ANCAP stuff, it's too focused on economics. What makes people free are people who say, fuck it, I am living the way I want.
Yes.
And I'm not going to be talking about marginal utility and blah, blah, blah. It's like, I am deciding how to live my life the way I want to, taking risks.
There's a great book about that's called A Renegade History of the United States. Yeah.
By the way, a phenomenal book,
well,
which I really very
absolutely
much enjoyed.
I think that's a false choice into the national high school curriculum.
Yeah. Oh, so
it would
would
never happen.
We're working on it. In fact, the teacher here, right here, is going to teach my book in a Catholic. Get
by
this.
By the way, that's fucking awesome.
No, don't. It gets better. You'll appreciate this. In a Catholic girl school.
Who would have thought?
That's going to
that would
well
be where the libertarian revolution starts.
For those of you who don't know, like a recent episode of Unregistered is me talking to a high school class, a public high school class in Sacramento, which was quite interesting. You might want to check it out.
Yeah. Like, I just don't... to me, I think it's a false choice to say you can either talk about marginal utility or you can live your life the way you want to live it. But let me just get, you know... Look, I'm saying, who is a better example of living their life the way you want to live it than me? I'm a comedian podcaster, and I support my family off of this. Like, I'm doing very well. I am doing that. However, to say, let's just not pay attention to the state. Like, okay, let's not. Well, how about those fucking babies starving to death in Yemen right now? Mm. How about the people rotting away in fucking cages all around us? So, okay, let's just not pay attention to that. That's what's happening here. So if we don't pay attention to the state, that's what we're ignoring.
That's a false choice my job is to, like, I've written my entire life against every military intervention that the U.S. government has done. I've written against prison policies. I've written in favor of ending drug prohibition. I've written in favor of drug use. I mean, these are like, you know, so, right. You know, in a weird way, maybe you are doing more of the world that I say I should be doing. And, you know, I am doing more of the world that you're saying you're doing, because all I do is fucking write about how the government is too big. It's inefficient. It's bad. What I'm getting at is a broader conception of saying, you know, if libertarians are obsessed to the point of distraction with the size of government every time and in all ways, I think we are shutting down a portion of our brains and our energy that could be devoted to just getting on with freedom. That's all. I think that's more of a personal kind of predilection or a default setting. I would never argue that this is what everybody should believe or anything like that.
I take the opposite. I think that the greatest struggle in human history is tyranny versus liberty. There is nothing that has been the greatest tyranny by far has been the state. Not to say there aren't others, but there's nothing that could even come close to comparing to it, or competing with it. And there's nothing better you could spend your time on than that. And you could say, well, yes, I don't like
so
the war.
Your stand-up is ending the war in Yemen?
Yes.
I'm not saying no, but it's like, yeah, then we're doing the same work, right?
Okay.
No, I'm not. It's not an attack on you as a person. I'm disagreeing with what you just said, and I'm saying that you can't separate. Well, there's this war on Yemen, and then there's these people sitting in cages, and but then there's just like the economic stuff, which we don't need to waste all our time with. Do you know what the income tax is? Do you know what it's done to people? What it's done to families? You know how many people have been ruined? How many divorces, suicides, destroyed families over the fucking debtors' prison.
Wait, do you equate the indiscriminate bombing of absolutely innocent people in foreign countries, or systematically putting whole populations of bad ethnic groups in jail for their lives with the difference between paying 39.6% as a top marginal rate and 30%.
It's that it's theft, right? That it's all theft. It doesn't matter what the percentage is your position, right?
Yes, so
it's
obviously one is worse than the other, but they're all evil.
It's pretty damn bad either way.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sympathetic to all that what Dave is saying. That's why I love the guy. But let me get, do you guys want to continue talking about libertarianism? Sure, why not? So you raised an interesting question. This is where I will start to probably agree with you more and less with Dave. We'll see. So, Dave, you are sort of you're associated with, you're close to guys I very much love in many ways, and I've learned a lot from, like, Tom Woods and people from the sort of Mises world there.
I'm going to Mises University in 2 days.
Mises University, and you are
what sports division are they in? Are they going to crack the SEC?
They're D6. Yeah. They got a sweet women's field hockey team.
So Nick says that libertarians are too narrowly focused on things like economics and the state. I agree, and I think especially from the Mises Caucus types. So Dave, you're involved with the Mises Caucus of the Libertarian Party, and that's those guys. Now, I have learned a ton about economics and the state from just those people. I used to be a huge Tom Woods fan. I studied it for like 2 straight years, and that's where I learned all the economics I could, because as you know, as a leftist, in graduate schools, they don't teach you anything about economics. So thank you for them and for that. But what I said last night and what I've been saying for a long time is one of the reasons I don't identify as a libertarian is that, yes, I think they tend to be too narrowly focused on those things, economics and the state, and what Marxists call the material conditions of life, which are important, but they are not all of reality. And it seems to me, interestingly, that the hardcore ANCAPs in the movement, in the libertarian movement, share that with Marxists. So there are forms, as Mr. Foucault, my man, Michel Foucault, says, there are forms of power that have nothing to do with the state, that are outside the state, but that undergird state power. So like what he calls norms, social norms. Without social norms, there are no laws, right? Without norms undergirding the laws, there are no laws. It is illegal to jaywalk in New York City, as everyone knows, but every single person in New York City jaywalks, right? Because there is no norm undergirding it, right? So... Nick, can you sort of lay out a little bit what you mean about what is missing in libertarianism? What layers would you like to add to it that are not there right now?
So an appreciation for experiments in living, for instance, a kind of like John Stuart Mill concept. And again, these are not either or things, but it's like, where are people right now inhabiting or creating interesting communities, new types of institutions, new methods of living, new lifestyles. What kind of art are they creating? How are they imagining what it's going to be like to be human in 25 years or whatever? So things like transhumanism, the idea of people doing kind of self-directed evolution. And again, this is not to the exclusion of saying, and so let's not worry about Yemen, because we do need to be, talking about all of this stuff. But an appreciation for what I would consider like kind of lived freedom or lived liberty.
Yes.
Because it's happening all over the place in all sorts of interesting ways, and in ways that undercut a lot of the tyranny of the norms that that you're talking about, or a Foucauldian reading, which would be like in a way you don't need laws to make gay people equal in society, mm-hmm. if they're treated equally.
That's right.
And that it's kind of
considered to be equal. Yeah. That's the norm.
As a perfect example for what you guys are saying, I mean, look at there's no better example of culture affecting politics than all of the politicians who used to say marriage is between a man and a woman. As soon as people were basically like, no, that's bullshit, and the opinion polls were over 50%, they all went, hey, we've been thinking about it. I think you're right about that. But like, I agree with all of that. And I mean, the thing that comes to my mind is just being I was a huge comedy fan before I became a comedian. And I love watching like great comedy. Dave Chappelle or Bill Burr or Louis C.K., pre and post jerk off, but I like.
I liked him during.
No, never
actually.
Got offered. Yeah. It was pretty, and I was hanging out, just like What are you up to later? You got a hotel room or anything? Nothing. But a lot of what they'll do is really great comedy, high level, George Carlin, a lot of these guys, what they'll do is they'll make you think about something that's always been a preconceived, like just a belief of yours and go, wow, I've never thought about it that way. So I'm all for, but to me, this is almost like, I look at libertarianism as a limited, philosophy, but I don't think that that's a bad thing. To me, libertarianism is abolitionism. It's the same thing as being an abolitionist. Now, you could go to an abolitionist and be like, this is the idea that you want to abolish slavery. I mean, this is kind of a limited philosophy. What job should the slave get once they're a free person? And you're like, yeah, that's important too. But all I'm saying is they shouldn't be a fucking slave. Like, that's my point. And that's what abolitionism is. So that, to me, is what libertarianism is. It's not saying there's more to life than that.
It's a political philosophy.
It's a legal philosophy, yeah, okay. Yes.
Legal. And it's about the relationship between the individual and the state.
Yeah, it's about...
And I guess...
And this is where it's limited for you and for me.
And I agree.
Like,
limited.
I agree with everything, yeah, every position you take on that, but there's more to life than that, and there's more to politics than that.
We should be libertarian in all aspects of our lives, because some people, and I think some people at the Mises Institute will say something like this, where libertarianism is a political philosophy. It has nothing to say about how you might live your private life your business life or something that isn't about the role of the state and kind of coercion.
However, they actually do. They actually pretty much shame people for certain forms of living.
Okay, that I don't know because I'm not familiar with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, how so?
Well, I mean, there's a long history of it. Going back to the Ron Paul newsletters, right?
All I was going to say is that, like, you should be libertarian through...
I don't want to...
Yeah, but this is, like, what I can't stand, man. It's like, going back to the newsletters, it's like, okay, look, man, there were some things that were written...
to the newsletters. Do you have newsletters? Do you have newsletters in your past that you're worried people are going to find? It's not like a small thing.
No, I'm young.
It's
I don't have newsletters in my past. I'm fucking old newsletters.
Did you mimeograph your newsletters, Dave?
I have tweets that I'm not so proud of. But this is just like, it's like, look, okay, fine. I just don't, it's like where, look, man, I think all of us, like, it's easy to say, like, this public school system, the media, Hollywood, all this stuff, right? They're like programming these kids. Mm-hmm. But then sometimes you step back and go, well, how am I programmed? Like, how have we all been programmed? Because if you're so offended, here's a perfect example of this, right? Okay, so Nick Sarwak, who I'll be debating at the Soho Forum, he is the chairman of the LP, right? He's outraged that Murray Rothbard said something nice about David Duke in the 90s, right? Because, and by the way, if you actually go read the article, I highly recommend you do. It's called The Case for Right-Wing Populism by Murray Rothbard. I'm a Jew. I support everything he said in that article. He didn't know David Duke was going to go turn again later and start saying more crazy shit. Forget it. Let me just make the point.
David Duke emerges as a Ku Klux Klan leader. It's not like, and then he dabbled in this or something. Okay, it's
Nick,
a fucked up,
Nick,
stupid point that Murray Rothbard made, and that's the point.
Okay. Can I finish what I was saying now? So maybe you'd get it. Yes. In his 20s, he was in the Klan. That, like, again, if you're a leftist and you're...
How many of you...
Nick,
members?
Let me fucking finish a point.
Nick.
Nick, like, that's what dude, it's like, okay, let me just get the point out, okay? And I bet you the room will agree with me when I'm done, okay? So, yes, if you were a leftist, by the way, who in his 20s was in some radical leftist group and then moved into the center, everyone would fucking praise you for moving into the center, which is, by the way, the point Rothbard made, if you actually go read the piece. But so, yes, so Nick Sarwak is outraged that Murray Rothbard said something nice about David Duke. And everyone here could go, man, David Duke, bad guy, racist, hates Jews. That's not cool. You shouldn't say this. Nick Sarwak praised John McCain when he died. Do you know how much fucking worse John McCain is than David Duke? Mm-hmm. You want to compare the two of them? Do you want to think about that one guy who says mean things and another guy who has mountains of corpses on his hands? You want to compare their track record? Mm-hmm. So that's all I'm saying.
That's the limit of libertarian politics. You're either fucking you're a lover of John McCain or of David Duke. Fuck you. That's ANCAP. It ain't my libertarianism. Okay.
Do you think that's what I just said? Does anyone think that's the point I was making?
No, my
point is that why are we so upset that someone in the 90s said, stop the LA riots. They wanted to go collect their welfare checks. Okay. You shouldn't have said that, but how about just saying, Bill Weld, the LP nominee, goes, Hillary Clinton, we disagree on some economic issues. That to me is 100,000 times more offensive than anything that came out of the Mises Institute in the 90s. Okay, I'm sorry. Like, you don't say Hillary Clinton should burn in fucking hell for what she did to Libya. You don't. But yet, so my point is, where, it's not saying it's one or the other. My point is, where are our moral priorities really?
Nice.
Okay. You know what? I'll tell you this. The problem with associating with white racists or white supremacists or with status monsters is that it makes libertarian a harder sell to people who don't already agree with us. And if you think that, like, people who were, like, hanging out or saying kind words about Ku Klux Klan leaders and stuff like that, that doesn't matter to people, it does matter to people. Mm-hmm. And it's like it should guide how you act now and how you go forward. I don't give a shit about Murray Rothbard. I don't give a shit about the Mises Institute. I don't care about Bill Weld. What I'm interested in is taking a sensibility and a philosophy that is about limiting government and increasing individual autonomy and freedom and respect and tolerance for people who want to live the weirdest fucking lives that we ever want to live, as long as it's peaceful. I want to sell that idea to more and more people.
I agree with you.
And that is why Murray Rothbard makes that much, much harder, because he was always willing to extend an olive branch to fucking racists, okay? And
not just racists, but statists.
Yeah.
Oh, right? Man. Okay. Let me
listen. Well, they
are. So, no, but that's why.
But no one seems to have a problem. But you don't have a problem as someone who's anti-statist, or accused me of being statist earlier. No one seems to have a problem with Murray Rothbard extending an olive branch to the new left in the '60s, who were straight up sympathetic to socialism because they were anti-war. Because he always extended an olive branch to the anti-war crowd. Because he, like me, and this is why he's my fucking, my
spirit animal.
Yes, why he is the guy who has more influence on me than anyone else is because he realized that mass murder was a more important thing to be against than to be against some. Look, man, and let me just say that, and this is my challenge to you, right? When you say this will make it a harder way to sell libertarianism at your next event, at the next Reason magazine event, that's your people there, ask the audience who sold them libertarianism more. Was it Ron Paul or Gary Johnson? And you tell me who was able to sell the message of libertarianism more. I don't care if he gave a speech in front of a Confederate flag once. I don't care.
And what happened was that Ron Paul's message in 2008 in particular was great. And we've talked about this, where he said, I don't want to run I don't want to run the economy. I don't want to run your life. And I don't want to run the world. That's a great message. And then what happens is, we have imperfect messengers of this kind of stuff. And none of this, I like Ron Paul a lot, and I think he's done a tremendous, amount of work in making libertarianism, somehow relevant.
Yeah.
But you're also now you're getting to a point where you're defending, it's just, he just hung out with a couple of racists. He just said a couple things. I'm not picking up anybody's baggage anymore. I don't need that, because I never thought about it that way.
I don't like racists. To be honest, I'm not completely sure what the word means. I swear to God, the term racism, to me, it seems like in the modern context in 2019, is a spectrum from genocide to saying the blacks instead of blacks. I swear to God, I'm not even exaggerating. I don't know what the term means anymore. If you mean genocide, slavery, Jim Crow, something like that, yeah, burn in fucking hell, you're evil. If you mean someone who holds some views that are not politically correct, then by the way, that's all of us, if we're being really honest with ourselves. So I don't even know.
That's wrong. That's wrong.
Dave, hold on. Let me interject here into my own show.
By the way, I love Nick Alexby, and I hope everybody knows
he
this.
He just hates Italian Americans.
That's it.
Is that I married an Italian American? Yeah. So yes, he's correct.
Boy,
I hate what I'm trying to say.
Have you noticed he has an answer for everything?
Can I?
No, let me ask you, Dave. So here's the thing. There are many libertarians, some of whom you hang out with, some of whom are associated with Mises, but others too, who simply, as far as I can tell, never mention race. They never mention gender. They never mention sexism. They never mention cultural norms at all, right? And what does that mean? I mean, if you go to the Lou Rockwell report, you won't see any mention of that, one way or the other. You won't see anything that's racist. You just won't see anything that's about race at all. Why is that? And don't you think that's a problem? Because this is kind of what Nick's been getting at, and what I've been getting at, is that there's just whole swaths of the human experience they simply don't address. And I don't know if that means they're racist, although I suspect it might, but it's simply that they're not interested in much of what life is for human beings.
Thank you so much, brother. I can say that that's flat out false. The idea that there's no address of race on the Mises website. I mean, Mises.org has addressed everything. Have you seen their archives? Go to Mises.org right now. Do it while we're here and type in race. I guarantee you there's articles that are written on it. Go to LouRockwell.com. I mean, they have this huge archive. So I don't know that that's true. But again, I don't exactly know. It's like going to some website that's dedicated to the abolition of slavery and saying you guys never talk about cooking.
Can I tell you why I think they don't ever talk about race, even though you think they do? It's the same reason that a lot of hardcore Marxists, including Bernie Sanders, don't talk about race. And Bernie Sanders didn't talk about race until the Black Lives Matter chicks got on the stage with him in Arizona and forced him to, by the way, during the campaign. Yeah. Remember that?
Pushed them off.
Remember that? He was like, Black Lives Matter, what's that? Because, and it's a good argument. I mean, it's not the one I would make, but in both cases, so the socialists say, once we have socialism, there will no longer be racism, right? Once we have economic equality, there will be no need for racism. That's the classic argument. That's Bernie Sanders' argument. It's always dragged into this identity politics by BLM. I think that a lot of hardcore libertarians, especially some ANCAPs, especially some people around the Mises Institute, but others, you know, say similar things. They will say, once the state is abolished, right, we will have no racism because we will have freedom and then no one will need to be racist. And I think that might be a problem.
Well, I've never actually heard anyone from Mises say that.
Or sexism.
I've heard them say,
negative cultural norms at all, right?
Well, so what I heard Murray Rothbard write, was that the Black Power movement and the Black Panthers were absolutely right when they said that the police don't work for them. He was like, you're right, the police don't work for them, don't work for you, and you should leave this system and you shouldn't be like responsible to these police. You should develop your own police networks. I heard Ron Paul say that to him, Martin Luther King was a hero because he his message was consistent with nonviolence and peace. So I don't know. I haven't actually heard them say anything like that. What I've heard Ron Paul say is that, who isn't technically Mises Institute, but is associated with them. What I've heard him say is that he thinks racism is essentially a form of collectivism and that it's kind of evil and repugnant and that you should judge people as individuals. But I don't think a lot of different people from the Mises Institute argue is that the best way to deal with the problem of racism is to have a market. And as free a market as possible. And by the way, if you don't think that's true, I mean, just look at the world. If you don't think that the free market is the best solution to racism, just think about it this way. Go on YouTube, look at every political video from the left and the right and the alt-right and Trump and what's the name of these four congressmen, the squad.
Yeah.
So the squad versus Trump and all this stuff. And look at all this stuff, all this. And you could be convinced after a YouTube journey that we're on the verge of a race war in this country. But then after that, go outside and go to the fucking store and you see people of all different races, of all different religions, all that. And it's kind of fine because you're trying to buy something and they're buying something and you're going home and no one really cares. That is the market versus the political. Mm. So that, I've seen that point made many times by people at Mises, and I think they're more or less right.
Amen, brother. Now, also, let's see. Like Marxists, libertarians tend to dwell on what sucks right now and tend to complain quite a lot. Now, I agree with them in many cases, and that's what we've been doing for a little more than an hour here. Yeah. How much the world sucks and the state sucks.
To be fair, it seems much longer.
Yes.
Can I say, though, and please finish, but this is where I think Nick and Rees Magazine are at their strongest.
Yes.
Is they're the best in the libertarian world at celebrating what's going
that's
good.
That's right.
And what we're doing as well. Yes. I love that about them.
Yes.
I think that's the best.
Now, Nick, you said something very interesting and exciting to me about 20 minutes ago, which was maybe we should be talking more about creating alternative communities, alternative ways of life.
Right?
I love that idea. Do you have any specific ideas about what to do there?
Well, you know, this...
Because I do.
Yeah, okay. I'm happy to hear what yours are, but it's, this is the... it's cheesy now, but something like Burning Man, not as a place that you live year-round, but as a demonstration project of just, changing it up every year and getting outside of your own head for a while or doing something like... And it started as an art project. Mm-hmm. The whole point isn't that you just go there and do a lot of drugs. It's that you go there and do a lot of drugs and then do weird art, or something like that. I think that's models. I was talking to some people who have a commune in upstate New York, and they go up there and they do various things. Any number of things like that. I like, you were talking to me the other day about cryptocurrencies that... Yeah, well, why don't you explain? This type of thing is, there are so many, I think Dave was getting at some of this too. There's just so much technological innovation that makes things possible. linkages and connections and ways of communicating and finding like-minded people that didn't exist before. And we realized that instead of only having... you'll love this because we're about the same age and you grew up in Berkeley. I'm a big fan of Steppenwolf, the Hermann Hesse book. It was like a really important novel to me as a kid. And the whole point of the book is that we are all, and it's really bad. I mean, I only read it in translation. It's dull and boring now, but I think it's powerful, that we have thousands or infinite numbers of identities within us, which are often at odds with one another. But we should pay attention to all of them and we should develop as many of them as possible. And I feel like we're in a world now, and this is where I believe in a kind of libertarian intersectionality, the idea that we have multiple different identities, none of them fully define us, they overlap, and we should be kind of exploring all of those and seeing what new third and fourth and fifth terms come from hanging out with our friends who we like about this and we like about this, and then we see people doing something interesting over there in business or in culture or in commerce. And you know, we're constantly remaking ourselves because we're incomplete, we're unfinished, we are running out the clock on a life where we have to provide our own meaning. Yep. I mean, I'm very much into, I'm kind of like a libertarian existentialist in that sense.
I like it.
And I think that that can provide a kind of humane vision that takes libertarianism from being fundamentally, and I think it is, it's ultimately a political philosophy, but it puts some flesh and some muscles on this skeleton, and it will make it more exciting and more appealing to more
people. Yeah, I think we need to have physical spaces. I think, so what we're doing at Renegade University, we're trying to establish outposts, we're calling them, across the country and even into other countries as well. Physical spaces where people can work, produce podcasts, can do media, and live for a time, and come and go. Now, we're open borders, right? So there's no, this is not a hippie commune where you're committed to the land and you're going to be there forever. People can come and go. And it's an open, porous system. That's number one.
Works pretty well without a welfare state.
Hang on. Yeah. Hang on. I got the answer to that, too. So here's the problem, right? A lot of our friends have been shut down from social media, right? And some of our friends have even been shut out of getting... they can't make a living because the credit card companies won't allow them to use them, and PayPal shut them out, like our Gavin McInnes and other people like that. So clearly, ultimately, I mean, that's going to happen to us, I think. At some point, they're going to come for us, no matter, you know, eventually we're going to say something that people don't like, and we're going to get shut down unless we have a couple of systems in place. We have permaculture, honestly, where we can grow our own food, right? And also, more importantly, cryptocurrency. So once we're in a cryptocurrency world, they can't get us unless they actually move in with tanks and expropriate our land and our property and our hard drives. Now, cryptocurrency, for those who don't know, and I'm new to this, but I got very, very excited about it, not by talking to a libertarian who's into crypto, but by talking to Daniel Coffeen, who was one of the guests on the show, who's basically a socialist of some sort, and he has been working with friends on developing a cryptocurrency coin, a community, which is a community in which portions of each transaction go to a general fund, which then funds a internal private welfare state that has unemployment insurance, medical care for those who need it, housing for those who need it, you name it. You can do whatever you want with cryptocurrency that is not statist, has nothing to do with the state, it is totally voluntary, and it is autonomous. Autonomous. I think that can happen, and that can be a total libertarian thing. You can have your own welfare state if it's private, right? But only through crypto. Only through crypto. So I actually think the future is really, really, really bright here. I think there's a huge potential, and I think it's actually inevitable that we're going to have all sorts of communities. Now, some of these communities, these crypto communities, will basically be communist gulags, no doubt about it, in some way or another. But we can establish our own, and we can even have this thing that libertarians suck about, which is like, well, what do I do when I'm out of money and broke and I have a hospital bill? And they say, well, you know, the market will fix it. In the meantime, there's a whole lot of anxiety for a long time for a lot of us, right? Capitalism is fucking anxious. I've been saying this for a lot of time. I've been saying this for a lot of time, and that's one of the things that libertarians don't really fully acknowledge. But I actually think there's an answer to it, and that's this. We now have, because of technology, because of the fruits of capitalism and the market, we have the ability to have our own welfare state that is not a state, that can take care of ourselves. We can take care of ourselves and other people through that. So it's quite exciting. What do you guys think?
I mean, that's
will you
amazing.
Join?
And sure,
good. I will accept the welfare. I'm not sure. I don't know if I'm going to work for it, but I'll accept the welfare.
Well, I mean, I think that
I'm going to test the system, stress test the system.
I genuinely don't know enough about it to, you know, see whether or not there's going to be problems in that model. I mean, okay, there'll be problems in any model, but what the cost versus benefit is. From what I've read about the cryptocurrency stuff, it does strike me that this has enormous potential, like enormous potential. That being said, I don't know. Look, there's a case for optimism. There absolutely is. I also think there's a really strong case for pessimism, and we would be not doing our jobs to not really grapple with that, what that case is, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, understand where we are in this government right now, like what's going on. And it's not just that it's like the biggest state ever, so they spend $4 trillion a year, whatever. Understand what's going on. We are the most militarized government that has ever existed. I mean, down to like, not just the military industrial complex, I'm talking about the Department of Education having a SWAT team, the EPA having a SWAT team, the 50 plus thousand SWAT raids that are happening every year. The fact that Obama just very casually signed into law that the government has the right to detain American citizens without trial and hold them indefinitely. Nobody's really taking him up on that. Nobody's really using it too much. Just the Muslims, but you know, not really the rest of us. But now Donald Trump's getting in. The politics are getting more and more. I know I'm the guy bringing it back to politics, but I do think this is important to focus on. Now we're in this age where you have this crazy democratic socialist left rising up, this crazy populist right rising up, and they're just getting more and more crazy. Like, it's really, in real time, we're watching the politics really go to like, holy shit. I mean, if Joe Biden were to run on what Obama ran on in 2008, they're like, you're a Klansman. You know, like, that's how crazy it's gotten right now. And this is very, very dangerous. So while we do have more potential to go into these like self-sustaining communities, I hope it all works out. I'm very worried about where this whole thing is like going, and I
this
think it
may
could
also
go bad.
Be the difference between your kid just was born and ours are out of the house.
Right, you know? That's true.
She might be right about that.
Are you still have your cable news gig? Are you still on cable news on a regular basis?
I had a contract with CNN for a while, but they didn't re-sign
oh,
me
Jesus.
When that contract.
Did you guys
came
see
up.
Him
was
on there ever?
Was there a particular thing that did you have a
No, it wasn't really, I'll be honest, I was hoping it would be like a more romantic story, like I just fucking smacked down the thing and then they kicked me off, but what happened was more or less that they moved the show and the time, and they just cut all of the contributors, and I was a contributor.
So you didn't
on
like
Cup
Pants
show.
Wolf Blitzer or
but
something?
I never had the opportunity to, but I will say what happened to me, I was almost happy when they didn't re-sign me, because what they did was, I basically had Essie Cup, I was a contributor on her show, and her big issue, that like her issue is the war in Syria, and how we have to fight the war in Syria because Bashar al-Assad is killing all of these people. So we obviously, everyone here knows the U.S. military are the good guys who go around the world, you know, saving everybody. So we have to go save all these Syrians from dying. And she's wrong about everything. And she hired me as like, oh, I'm this comedian who will come on and like tell a few jokes in between these segments. But I know way more than her. Not like I'm some smart guy. I just have Scott Horton phone number. So like I know way more than she knows about this shit. And I would just, we would have these battles, and like three or four different times I have these great clips of me and Essie, me taking on this CNN anchor number one issue who doesn't know shit about her number one issue. And then after we had those like three clips, she just stopped letting me talk
about
war.
Greatest thing I've ever seen on cable news by far.
Well,
everyone Google it. Dave Smith on Essie Cup talking about Syria and a couple other things. You just absolutely laid her out. I mean, these were epic speeches you gave on those panels. And it was really some of the best stuff I've ever seen on even television in terms of politics.
Oh, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And then, well, thank you. But then she just... She basically, after that, would just stop letting me talk. Like, they wouldn't have me on for the stuff I wanted
and
to talk about.
And that's why you're slumming it here with me tonight. Yes.
But I still, I do Kennedy's show on Fox Business all the time. And Kennedy's the fucking best, by the way. Nick's on that show a ton. And she's like, to me, Kennedy is like a hero. Like, she's one of the only people who really, she has... voices from all over, and every time, and even if I know there's a lot of purists out there, and this is like a lot of, and I get this from a lot of like ANCAP people too, who are like me, but they'll be like, oh well, she took the wrong position on this, or she took the wrong position on that. It's like, who else do you know who has a cable news gig, who's the host, who's lasted this long and made it successful, and has had, maybe it's not her making the argument, but you'll hear the argument on her show that Assad didn't gas his own people. That was a false flag, which it was.
Although the last...
So, like, just, I promise you that was a false flag.
Yeah. Hey, I think it's time to hear from you guys. So what we're going to do is I'm going to give you this mic because we only have three. So if anyone wants to come up, and I want you to come up, I'll give you my mic and you can ask questions of any one of us. So take your time thinking. We can edit out the pause here. You can also go get more drinks if you want to loosen up the mind. You want to take a break?
I don't like that was way more popular than asking us questions. People went, drinks? Fuck yeah.
Or we can just go. We're ready to go. Whatever you guys want to do. So come on up.
Hey, Dave. My name is Alex. Live in Brooklyn. Dave Smith, Nick Gillespie, say something nice about each other. No, I'm just kidding.
But by the way, that's not hard. As I said many times, I was a fan of Nick Gillespie before anyone in the libertarian world knew who I was. I was reading Reason Magazine. I think these guys do incredible work. Like, Reason Magazine is one of the greatest publications in the universe. That's very easy for me to say. So anyway, I know you were half joking, but I'm serious.
And I'm trying to remember what Hillary said when she was asked to say something about Donald Trump. And it's like, well, you know, he's closer to death than to birth or something. Now, I enjoy, Dave does a stand-up gig at all of the Soho forums, which Reason helps sponsor, which are great. And your podcast is great. And I like what Dave does very much.
Cool. So my question is, my girlfriend and I just signed a lease on a teeny apartment in Brooklyn. She was homeschooled partly. I was very conventional, tortured in public school. We both are at the same kind of education level. She did great. You know, she just finished her master's MFA at Columbia. I have a master's. We're, you know, constrained in time and money like everyone else. And in the non-zero chance that we have a kid, what the fuck do we do, you know, limited time and resources about the education thing? I know there's a lot of opportunities, there's a lot of new things, but what do you guys think? I know you have different, slightly different, and Thad, I could add, because since you're a pioneer in this, what should we do?
And your son was born when you were at Columbia, or?
My son was born when I was a professor at Barnard College in 2001, yeah.
I don't know. You guys got the older kids. You answer. What do you do?
I'm trying to introduce washed carrots. Look at what I did, and then do the opposite.
So what I did was I put my kid in a prison for 13 years.
Yeah.
Now that wasn't entirely my choice because there was this other person involved in it in the decision making, known as my ex-wife. You know, so I couldn't really convince her to do anything unusual like that, to take him out of a public school, and I regret it. I hated it every single minute, but I really had no choice. Also, here's the worst part: he wanted to go to a public school because he thought that's how you got socialized. Right, because that's what he learned, and that's that from the culture. So that was a really hard thing to overcome.
There's a really good book that just came out called Unschooling. Okay, and I actually find the unschooling movement really kind of interesting. It kind of came of age in the 1970s, but it has older roots, and it's gone through various kind of revolutions and stuff like that. The one problem with that, and it's where, you know, and this goes to the way you were talking about your nephews, I mean, like, or, you know, young kids like really want to learn. And this book, what blew my mind in it was that it had a description of how kids learn how to read and do math without instruction. And I'm like, that can't possibly be fucking true, but it is. Having said that, the problem with that is I do think that's a model that requires having one parent be basically a full-time attendant to the kids.
However, there is a network, two networks, large national networks of basically unschooling schools. In fact, we're registered, we're working on with the Hudson Valley Sudbury School, which is an amazing place, and it's part of a network of schools. There are about 30 or 35 Sudbury schools around the country, and then there's another one called the Liberated Learning Alliance, I think, Learners Alliance, again, a national network of schools. The Sudbury School is really radical. It is the students run the school. That is K through 12. There is no segregation among the ages, which is nice too. I forget who said this, but like, it is the craziest thing to segregate these children by age. So you can only speak to you can only speak to like the people who are your. Can you imagine if you can only speak to people your age? right? How? What a great way to retard children's development, right? To not allow them to speak with adults or to help younger people or anything like that. So if you go to the Sudbury School, you walk in the door, I actually wept because it was just pure freedom. And there's some problems there, but the kids run the joint. I mean, they make the rules. They actually do hiring and firing of teachers. It's a little much. The only problem I have with it, the Sudbury model, and I spent a whole day there making an argument to the 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds and 7-year-olds and 8-year-olds.
We're like, no, you're not getting hired.
That democracy, kids, is puritanical. Because now, have you noticed that when you're actually making decisions in the community forum that you can't play anymore, that it's work, kids? So I kind of was planting the seeds of anti-democracy, you know, because that's what I do. But nonetheless, the Liberated Learning Schools, as far as I know, I haven't visited one yet, but I think there's none of that democracy bullshit. They just basically let the kids do what they want. And in both schools, the Sudbury School in Hudson Valley, I swear to God, has an entire room devoted to video games. So there's just monitors, and I swear the kids just, if they want to, they can spend all day long playing Black Ops. No kidding, just video games. And there was another room where they were just playing Dungeons and Dragons all day long, led by one of the teachers. You can go into the, it's next to the woods, it's in the Hudson Valley, you can go into the woods and there's just a boundary that you can't even see. So the kids are actually allowed to go by themselves, 5-year-olds, just walk into the woods and be there for as long as they want. They built their own playground, too.
This is sounding like an M. Night Shyamalan movie, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
The kids. The one thing that worries me, actually, about radical school choice is so many of the things that I loved growing up, like Pink Floyd's The Wall or any number of, you know, like, it's all born out of the oppression and the authoritarianism and the boredom of school. Rock and roll wouldn't exist without kind of public schools just creating a dead brain effect among kids.
So you want to maintain the oppression of children so that we can have rock and roll? Is that it?
That's a dangerous game, my friend.
But then the other thing is that, you know, there are already more and more choices within the public school system. There are more and more choices among private schools and things like that. So.
Yeah.
And the other, you know, the other thing I think there used to be a popular concept in sociology about total institutions that are large. You know, it could be the corporation or the prison, the army, the school, and Frederick. Oh God, what's his documentarian who helped create like Cinema Verite and whatnot? He did Wiseman. Thank you, Frederick Wiseman did a documentary called High School. And it was high school as a total institution, and it's a terrible place. It's like being in the army. He did one called Basic Training.
Great film.
Well. And, you know, don't think of school as a total institution. So, like, whatever you're doing for your kid is not going to determine everything about them.
One other thing about unschooling and homeschooling, it's a different landscape now. So 20 years ago, it was basically Christian conservatives like Dave. But now...
Yeah.
But now...
Praise Jesus.
Yes. But now... now there are multiple networks of unschooling, and you have lots of parents of all kinds of politics, you know. And I've been interviewing some, and some will be on my show soon. But, yeah. So you have to be communitarian in a sense, right? Learn something from the left here. Join together, form a network of other parents in your neighborhood, and you can do it collectively, right? It's actually doable. See, I always said, because all these asshole libertarians are like, why did you put your son in that prison, Thad, if you don't believe in it? I'm like, dude, give me 8 hours a day and a bunch of money and I will, you know, homeschool him. So no, you can actually do it now through collective effort, right? Outside the state. So it is a possibility, and you don't have to be teaching them the Bible either. You can do it with people who actually think like you. So there really is a bunch of new possibilities, brand new, many of them facilitated by technology, but there's a lot of things you can do with children that will keep them out of the state and keep them relatively free.
Yeah, I love all of that. I think that's great. I think there's a lot more more options that are arising. I know, like the Ron Paul wrote a book about this, has a homeschool curriculum. There's just interesting things out there. I would say this, right? Just think about what public schooling really is. And the best thing I've ever heard in my life was Tom Wood's analogy about, which is just, I think this is so fucking brilliant. But he goes, say it wasn't the government that ran the schools. Just imagine it was Walmart. Okay? Imagine Walmart took all of your kids, from K through 12. And they would bring your kids in, and the first thing they would have them do is pledge allegiance to Walmart. Okay? And then you would look around the room, and there were nothing but pictures of all the Walmart CEOs. And they would talk about what great people they were and just make up propaganda. Like, the first Walmart CEO never told a lie. Like, that's, you know, he got caught chopping down a tree and was like, no, I can't. And just imagine anyone except the state was doing this to our children.
Right.
You would look at that and go, this is fucking sick.
Yeah.
And I would die before I let my kid go be indoctrinated in this. And just saying, maybe you should think about it that way.
I want to check with Dave in a couple years when his kid's gone to kindergarten, and we're going to see because there is a there's an exigency of this, of like you have your ideals and you try to live by your ideals, but it is true that public school is bad. I think school is bad because public school is doing a shitty version of private school for the most part, but it's kind of an oppressive pedagogy. It's an oppressive relationship, but we'll see.
That's a fair point, because I don't like, and this is what makes me almost uncomfortable in saying it, I don't like talking it without walking it, and no matter what I say here, I can't walk it because my kid's 7 months old. That being said, over my dead body will my kid be in public school. So when we check back in,
she's going to be going to Walmart. To the Walmart Academy.
I would rather that. I would rather just go to the Walmart school. Yeah. At least we would all laugh at it. This is almost why I prefer monarchy to democracy, because at least everyone knows what's up with monarchy.
That's right.
This king is full of shit.
Exactly.
In democracy, like, the government is the people, you know.
Exactly, exactly. By the way, Renegade University will be having high school courses pretty soon. So.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Anyone else? Come on up, Dutch.
Hello, Dutch. Nice to meet you guys. Big fan of both of your work. You keep tacitly endorsing Catholicism. We're going to start calling you Trad Russell if you just keep it up.
There you go. There you go.
question for you guys, I guess maybe just more of an observation and like an open-ended thing that you can both talk about. But it seems the tedious nature of the conversation of libertarian versus anarchism that you find boring or tedious. I kind of agree with that sentiment, and I kind of think that anything else is kind of talking shit, which is a lot of fun, which is great fun to do, to sit around, get high, and like, you know, talk about politics and talk about philosophy and things like this, and it's really useful.
The best thing is, if you get high enough, you don't even need anybody else to be talking to.
Correct. But when it comes to the politics of libertarianism versus anarchism, I feel like it's kind of all nestled in the tradition of American pragmatism, which you do get into the weeds of 30% taxes versus 10% taxes, which makes you more free. Is there, I think you made a best point, one of the best points of the night, sorry, that one of the best points of the night last night at the SOA Forum, is liberty conducive with politics? Which I thought the answer was, no, it's not.
Right.
So all that being said, even if it is just fun talking shit, what is the importance, and is there any value or utility to intellectual vanguards like people like that are anarchists that may not move the needle politically in any sense that they're going to get Ron Paul elected or not elected? And I know what you guys think of the people that make the difference as far as, I want to do drugs, I'm going to do drugs, whether it's legal or not. So outside of the Renegades and Thad's books, how do we look at, or how do you guys feel about intellectual vanguards that do this thing that aren't the everyday common person, but are the people that are spouting off, you know, the Murray Rothbards, and even in a more contemporary setting is like a Cody Wilson who, you know, does something like that.
Cool.
I'll jump in. I mean, you know, and David talked about Ron Paul, and like, there's no question that Ron Paul in 2008 and 2012 changed the political landscape in a way that we won't fully understand the impact of that. But by saying things like, I don't want to run your life, I don't want to run the economy, and I don't want to run the world, because in a free world, you know, you get to run your own life, that's going to pay off down the road. And I think it already is. And there's going to be a lot of darkness before all of that. But I believe in the idea, the role of vanguards, or of almost sacrificial lambs, of, you know, people who do stuff and they are, you know, I'm a big fan of Jack Kerouac. You know, and these are the mad ones. You know, the dreamers, the people are, you know, exploding across the sky like rockets and spiders, and everybody goes, oh, like those people, intellectual vanguards, cultural vanguards, personal, you know, people who live or walk the walk, they make all the difference in the world. And, you know, Thad and I were talking in a different conversation about materialist kind of historians versus kind of idealist ones. And it in the end, you know, material conditions matter, but it's ideas that change the world. And it's not, you don't, Archimedes, I guess, needed a lever. Like, the lever is a metaphor. I mean, it's about words, it's ideas, and it's that example that you set.
Just real quickly, so Nick just moved from Marxist to Hegelian, just for, yeah, so you know, but anyway.
So I...
The important thing is that we stay in Germany.
So you mentioned, right, like Ron Paul, even though he wasn't able to get elected or something, right? And this is like this dynamic that I almost think is a false choice that is made a lot between. It's like, well, you know, do you want to just kind of be this intellectual thinker who's making these points and making people rethink things, or do you want someone who can get elected? Well, you tell me the guy who got elected and actually did anything for liberty. Who, Ronald Reagan? He grew the size of government about as much as anybody, except for the last two presidents, or last three presidents, in American history. Donald Trump, you know, he played to these alt-right guys to get elected. Donald Trump's first foreign trip that he went on in his first year of presidency, he dropped, you know, all this like Muslim ban and radical Islam. He dropped off $100 billion in weapons to the most radical Islamists on the face of the planet, the Saudis, and then went and kissed the rings of the Jews in Israel. So do you need any better like proof that democracy doesn't work than that? And by the way, still waiting on that wall. I don't want the wall. I'm just saying, you're not getting it, the people who voted for him, to get this wall. So it's all like this idea that I actually don't think politics, and this is to the point you were making, I don't think politics or statism, and politics is kind of like the theater to control the power of the state. I think this is the antithesis of individual liberty. The idea, it's like trying to turn the mafia into a human rights organization. It's never going to work that way. However, if the mafia happened to have a big show every 4 years where we talk about who the next Don is going to be, and someone wanted to get up there and say, hey, does anyone really have the right to be a Don and blah, and could change some people's minds, then that's useful. So I actually think the only thing that's useful is people using the political theater to change people's minds. Because at the end of the day, whether through democracy at the ballot box doesn't do anything, but real democracy, like what you guys were talking about before, what the people actually believe, changes everything. So if there's, you could have some brutal dictator who, you know, and 500,000 people show up on his palace, you know, with torches, and they're like, we demand policy X. And then that dictator goes, you know, I've been thinking about it, and I'm going to institute policy X. That's how change actually ends up happening, because the people are over it. And they, so that to me is like, that's all that matters, is changing people's minds. That's all that this thing is all about to me.
Can I follow up?
Nope, I'm satisfied for now.
So democracy, Dave, you're not a fan.
No.
Yeah. And so I know that about you. And guess what? You guys, you weirdos, you ANCAPs, you've kind of convinced me of this. Nice. That democracy's not so fun. Now, I respect. I first of all, I like the argument that you guys make, which is that it's, you know, the tyranny of a minority, right? And I like that in itself. But I don't like democracy for the reason I don't like socialism, because it's just so goddamn much work. Right, I don't want to manage society. I don't want to decide, you know, which streets are paved.
We gotta get going. We gotta shut this down and go to the block party and vote on everything.
Yeah, right? Everything. I mean, and the more democratic it is, the more decisions we have to make.
And you think about the idea, right? Like what these democratic socialists propose is that we're going to have the government involved in more and more and more of the economy, but don't worry, everyone will get to vote on it. But how can you possibly expect the average voter to have the knowledge, to have the expertise to vote on how we run the healthcare system and the financial system and the monetary system and go down the list of, you know, everything, the housing industry and all these other things? I mean, it's like, look, this is not how life works. If you're in a car and the car breaks down. And like, there's four of us in the car, and there's me, a New York City Jew who's never owned a car in my life, and two other people who don't know anything about cars, and one guy's an auto mechanic. We don't go, hey, let's vote on what we should do. We go, you know, so you inform us what is the correct course of action here, and we defer to that person. The
and idea then that you we're all say, like, I can't really help change the tire because my back hurts.
As you go, I have a pinched nerve, and I would love to. I'll be on traffic duty, then of course, like, to me, the more important principle is the first one that you mentioned. I mean, the practical argument that we can't waste all of our time. You can't expect everybody to all waste their time becoming a politician and voting on all of these things. But to me, the more important thing is just that nobody has a right to vote on your freedom.
Now,
like, it doesn't matter if slavery became popular with 65% of the people or 49% of the people. It's just as evil. Who the fuck cares who someone else votes on? By the way, have you ever met people before? A lot of them suck. So who cares what they vote for?
Exactly. This sort of reminds me of this thing that happened to Radley Belko, who used to write for Reason, you know, who didn't write much about democracy, but I guess he had one little piece written many years ago in which he had a couple of paragraphs in which he sort of just, in a toss-off comment, said something about democracy being not so great. And that was used when he was rising in fame because he was writing about, you know, the militarization of the police and criminal justice and mass incarceration and things that the left should love. Instead of focusing on that, they simply cherry-picked. They went back and looked on the Reason archives and found Radley saying something negative about democracy, and that was the reason to dismiss him. Now, was there an argument made against Radley's position on democracy? No. Ask an American, even an educated American, even a socialist American living in Brooklyn, why democracy is good, and they will have no answer. It is religious thinking, in my view. Now, there are arguments for democracy that have been made, but ask an American why democracy is good. You know what I mean? It's blank.
And it's not just religious thinking. Right. It's not just religious thinking. It's not even democracy. It's just the word. Like, they don't even associate it with a thing. It's just this kind of, like, good democracy.
That's it.
So
like God.
Bob Murphy said this on my show, which I thought this really stuck with me. But he went, you know, I bet you, if Donald Trump came out and said, we're going to have a vote on whether CNN should be shut down, and 60% of people voted that CNN should be shut down, they would say, this is a dark day in democracy. You know what I mean? But that actually would be completely consistent with democracy if you could just get a vote to support it. So it's not even that they really think about the principle of democracy. It, like you said, it's just this religious dogma that you have to support it. Well, why? Why would you support it if it's democratic? Either you like the policy or you don't like the policy. But who cares what 51% of people think about it? Why would that make the difference?
Yeah. Yeah, so I think that some people at Reason support democracy, right, Nick? Do you? Do you want to destroy your reputation now, too?
I was taking a little nap, which was helpful.
Were you? Good. I'm glad you're getting older. No. It's good.
But no, I mean, I was going to say, I moved back to New York in September after many years away, and I had spent all either part-time or full-time of the past 20 years living in small-town Ohio. And even there, I was going to say, I think you guys are hanging out with too many coastal elites, because there's a lot of skepticism about democracy. And I think that most people in America understand, you know, there's certain things that are going to be put up to a vote, but that there are certain inalienable rights, or that there are limits to government, and that you can't vote away certain types of rights and things like that. And that might also just be like the cockeyed optimist in me. But
we have time, I think, for one more question. Quickly, though, I'm going to go all the way in the back. Come on up. Or no, right here. Sorry. This is good. I'm sorry. I wish we had more time, but we don't.
Okay. So my question is for Dave, and I want you to know where I'm coming from. Like, you, Woods, Malice, later on Horton, like, brought me from being, like, somebody who was Googling how to join the Proud Boys to being, like, a fucking anti-war market anarchist. Like, this is the problem. This is what, like, no one cares enough about what's important kind of thing.
By the way, can I just say, and I'm very interested to hear your question, but that really makes me feel good. And no one ever fucking gets that.
Right.
Because everyone will go, they'll be like, oh my God, Dave had Cantwell on his podcast, or Dave had Richard Spencer on his podcast. And it's like, well, yeah, the reason I have them on my podcast is because I want their fucking audience back on my side.
Right. Okay.
So, and the truth is that, and so I'm glad, and I don't know what your question's going to be, but I'm just saying, it's like, when, like, it's like, okay, so you think you're just going to be the left and go, ah, you're evil. And that's just going to draw more people to them because you're not engaging with their ideas at all. So that actually makes me feel very good. And I'm a, I like Gavin, but, you know, the Proud Boys
your question is going to be whether...
Let's get real.
Just gay. I was going to say, is your question, like, can you start masturbating again now that you're listening to
today's
podcast?
Okay. Hold on, I'll take that once a week.
So,
but that's twice on holiday weeks.
So I've been getting into a lot more of Thad's work, and one of the things that brought me around where I was kind of like playing with the ideas to like really getting into them was actually your piece For Reason, that like 40-minute takedown of Jordan Peterson on postmodernism, right? And so one of the things that I deal with, because I am still a Christian, I don't really identify as conservative, but I am really fond of the bourgeois norms and things like that. But, you know, the work you've done talking to sex workers, and like I will all day like agree with you and with Woods and probably Lou Rockwell, but I don't listen to him as much. But like on like, yeah, I don't have to say a good thing about it. I just agree that we shouldn't be locking these women up. But at the same time, as long as the majority of people in the room are going to hear sex work and be like, ugh, they're still going to be okay with, you know, putting women in cages, or maybe just having the sexist view of women that like we should just put the Johns in cages, even though that puts them out of work and is going to leave them like so like, do you think that that's a problem? I'm like just bringing it back into that question that got really contentious between like you guys, but like do you see that as a problem for the Mises crowd? Like you were saying before, being so focused on economics and the market and just saying that's going to take care of everything without deciding to address societal norms and what people do in their life outside of like politics, economics, and the state, the size of the state, and the role of the state.
So that is a very good question. But so are you asking what I think, like, I just want to be clear on what you're asking. So is it that to me, the libertarian answer to this stuff, and this is what makes you a libertarian, in essence, is that you go, look, I may feel one way about prostitution, you may feel another way about prostitution. We both have our right to feel that way, but people own their own bodies and can do what they want, and no one should initiate force against them.
Right.
So let's let the chips fall where they may, and maybe your cultural values will win out, and maybe mine will. And the way we can fight for them is by arguing with each other or making your point, and that's that. But are you asking, look, I think that most of the people at the Mises Institute, not all of them, by the way, but most of them, are what we would consider more socially traditional.
Sure.
And I gotta say, from my own perspective, I hear a lot of arguments out there, and I've gotten into some spats on Twitter. I know you commented it on one thing, and I was like, I'm not prepared to take on Thad right now on this. But I would look, I'm not. But I have heard a lot of arguments about how empowering and wonderful being a sex worker is. I'm fairly skeptical of this. My mother was a psychologist. I tend to personally err on the side more of believing that a lot of these women who get caught up in the sex work industry are people who were abused as children, who are recreating their abuse in a dynamic where they take more power. But, you know, that might just be my own personal view. Maybe I'm wrong about that. At the end of the day, to me as a libertarian, it doesn't matter, because I will fight for your right to do whatever you want to with your body as long as you don't aggress against anyone else. And yes, there are way more problems associated with it being a black market. I know for a fact it would be a better situation if it was legal than it is being illegal.
So to make my question like as specific as I can make it, because I agree with you, and I agree with everything you said, is the way we think getting in our own way to be able to end the carceral state?
The what state?
The carceral state.
Oh, okay.
Mass incarceration.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
And is that a problem that the Mises crowd needs to grapple with and address and come around to Nick and Thad on?
I mean, no one's been speaking against mass incarceration more consistently for more years than the Mises crowd. I mean, there might be some people tied.
No reason. Yeah.
No.
But... Sorry.
I will grant Nick Gillespie a tie, yeah. But I wouldn't say more. I'm saying no one more. I'm saying they've both been great on this issue. Look, Ron Paul made this one of his major campaign issues. If you go read Lou Rockwell's book, Against the State, an Anarcho-Capitalist Manifesto. The first chapter is about war. The second chapter is about the war on drugs. These are like the most important issues. So I think that in the same way that libertarians are going to say, well, I stand up for someone's freedom to be in a gay marriage, or I stand up for someone's freedom to be a transgender or live your life in whatever you're a sex worker, whatever you want to be, I also stand up for someone's freedom to live in what's considered a more traditional lifestyle, and you have every right to do that. And like, no, I don't think the idea of you can walk and chew gum. I don't think the idea that you say, hey, I think there are some societal norms means that if you violate these, you should be thrown in a cage. I just don't buy that, I guess.
I'll just to add to it, and this goes against my earlier discussion of saying ideas really matter. There are material realities that matter, and including, you know, prisons are really expensive.
Yeah.
States are looking to cut money because they're all fucking out of money, and they got to figure out how they're going to pay for these pensions that they've been promising for decades that they haven't been saving for and things like that. One of the things that is genuinely great about the current moment, and there's a lot of reasons to be worried about the future, is the carceral state is being both dismantled in many ways. We are putting fewer people in prison. We are also changing policies, and we're having different discussions about it. And some of this is based on ideas. Some of it is more pragmatic, of just like things like, you know, there is a movement afoot to get rid of the cash bail system. And one of the things that has come out about that is just like when academics started looking at this, and it had no effect. Like making somebody post a cash bond had no effect on whether or not they show up for trial and things like that. And circulating that kind of information is more and more. And we have one of the most comical moments in the 2020 election, and this is going to be the worst fucking election of our lifetime. It's not the most important, but it is going to be the worst because it's the most recent. But Kamala Harris, who is a terrible carceral state prosecutor and attorney general for California, is now being forced to basically shit on her entire record as a prosecutor and pretend that she's in favor of criminal justice reform.
Yeah.
I don't want her to be president. I don't want her to win. I don't want anybody to win. I mean, I think it would be good.
Marianne.
Because, yeah, very well. But, you know, we're getting into a space now where the thinking on a lot of this stuff is changing.
Yeah, that reason piece on, what was the title? Kamala Harris is a cop who wants to be president was incredible. And let me just, the fucking nerve of that woman to go after Biden for not supporting mandated busing at a federal level when she was an aggressive prosecutor. For her to talk about Donald Trump separating parents from their kids from their families. It's what she did for a living. This was her job.
Well, they played hooky.
That is real. It is really amazing to watch.
Well, and she, with the busing thing, she even a couple days after the debate was like, by the way, I agree with Biden completely.
And then Chris Matthews goes on MSNBC. He goes, but you know, it was never really about the policy. It was about the emotion and understanding.
This is one of the, hopefully 2020, and you know, this is where I'm a really naive optimist. Each of these elections becomes a clarifying moment where people, you know, actually start to understand how much bullshit is being spewed. And, you know, we become deconstructionists. We become deconstructionists or postmodernists, and we realize that we need to be more critical readers and consumers of information.
Yep. I want to say thank you to the best fans ever, the smartest fans ever, for coming out. The first unregistered live. I think it was a success. And two of my favorite guys in the whole wide world, Nick Gillespie, Dave Smith, thank you. And we will do this again. We will do this again. Thank you very much.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a supporting member of the show, go to unregisteredlisteners.com. And thanks for listening.